Tune in, y'all, to the Force Live Podcast, where we talk movies and make it last. Jason Kleber, the host with the knowledge, breaking it down, man, he's always polished. We got the Force flowing like Jedi Knights, discussing films that take us to new heights. From the classics to the modern day hits, top five lists, man, we're dropping them quick. Lights, camera, action, we're in the zone. The Force 5 crew, we're never alone. We dissect movies with precision and flair, covering genres from here to everywhere.
What's up, listeners? Welcome to this Force 5 mini-episode. I am your host, Jason Kleberg. On this week's mini, we'll talk about what Steve Barnes and I missed on our list of top 5 fictional bands. I'll talk about what I've been watching, ending with a spoiler-free review for The Last Stop in Yuma County. And before I sign off, I'll tell you who's going to be on next week, and you're going to want to stick around for this one. It is a good one. Now, before I get into the show stuff, I wanted to acknowledge the passing of the King of Cult, Roger Corman. I found out about his death like an hour ago, so it's tough not having a true, worthy tribute to a person who gave me and millions of others so many hours of entertainment. The man produced something like 400 films, directed over 50 himself, but I did write kind of an obituary that I think he'd be proud of, so here goes. Roger Corman, the prolific filmmaker who turned B-movies into an art form, has directed his last scene. Corman, often hailed as the Pope of pop cinema, departed from the set of life at the ripe age of 98 years old. Known for his frugality and flair, Corman made over 400 films. His knack for finding talent was unparalleled, launching or helping the careers of luminaries like Jack Nicholson, Francis Ford Coppola, Martin Scorsese, and James Cameron. If there was a Hall of Fame for making a lot out of a little, Corman would be its unchallenged king. Corman's films, ranging from The Little Shop of Horrors to my favorite, Death Race 2000, were known for their campy charm, quick production schedules, and ability to make audiences both cringe and cheer. He never met a plot twist he didn't like, or a monster he couldn't bring to life on a shoestring budget. Corman's legacy in the film industry is monumental. He taught us that creativity is not about having the biggest budget, but the boldest ideas. Roger is survived by his loving family, countless protégés, and a filmography that's likely still premiering on late-night TV channels, and certainly on Tubi. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that you watch something he produced, and revel in the genius that was Roger Corman. Because if there's one thing Roger taught us, it's that sometimes the best stories are the ones you never saw coming.
I know that you've worked with, you gave so many people their start, so many great talents their start. Francis Ford Coppola worked with you before he really worked with anyone else, isn't that true?
Yes, right. As a matter of fact, he was the sound man, the second assistant director, and shot second unit all on one picture.
Really?
Very, very versatile.
Okay, and did you know then this kid's going places?
Actually, I knew he was good. I had no idea that he was going to go to the heights he did.
Okay, Ron Howard, I think, also
Ron
got
Howard
one of his first directing jobs with you, is that right?
He started with us as an actor, and the picture was called Eat My Dust, a car chase film. It was a big success, and he came into the office and he said, I know you want to do a sequel. When a star plays a role in a successful film, he always asks for more money.
Right.
I will star in the next picture, no more money, and I will do an additional job. And I said, what is that? And he said, I'll direct. And I said, Ron, you always look like a director to me.
No. You influence the way film trailers are made. I think many people, especially young people, think that film trailers have always been similar. But no, you really changed the way they were made with a certain innovation. What is it you did?
Well, it was Joe Dante, who went on to become a very well-known, successful director, who started cutting trailers for us. And he was cutting one trailer, and I looked at it, and I said, Joe, this is a fairly dull trailer. What can you do to jazz it up? He said, come back this afternoon. I went back this afternoon, and there was the same dull trailer. In the middle was an exploding helicopter. It made the trailer.
Well, let me ask you a question. Was there an exploding helicopter in the film?
There is no law that says everything in the trailer has to be.
Normally, this is where I'd give a top five of his filmography, but I'm going to hold off in the hopes that somebody someday picks Roger Corman films as a top five list or a draft. If you loved Roger Corman and you want to be the person to come on the show to do that, let me know at force5podcast@gmail.com and let's get it on the board.
There's nobody in there that he didn't, in the most important way, support. He was, you know, my main connect, my lifeblood to whatever I thought I was going to be as a person. And, you know, I hope he knows that this is not all hot air. I'm going to cry now. Not just me, who's very sentimental, but these other people also love him.
All right, last week, Steve Barnes from Sweet Child of Time joined me to talk top five fictional bands, and the internet was quick to let us know what we missed.
Not in the top five, did they get it right?
Excuse my language.
Okay.
Hell no. I can't believe. Who made that list? Who made that? That's blasphemous.
Don't look at me.
That's blasphemous.
Over on Twitter, your next favorite movie, at YNFMoviePod, said, haven't listened to the episode yet, but Sing Street has to make the list, right? Sing Street is still a film I haven't seen, and I know I need to get on that. People have recommended that to me for years. At Faux Bravo said the Ain't Rights from Green Room. At I Seen It Pod said Rudderless, The Clash at Demonhead, and The Soggy Bottom Boys. At Soundtrack Cast, Soundtrack Your Life said Wild Rats. At 1999, the podcast said The Wonders from That Thing You Do. At DBS _ Press, Dracula Beyond Stoker said Eddie and the Cruisers. At Wojo Duke said Stillwater. And Lindsay Dunn said The Wild Stallions. If you want to tell me what we missed on a list or even send me film recommendations, you could do so at force5podcast@gmail.com or find me on Twitter at force5pod, and your comment might be read on the show. Speaking of listener recommendations, I got an email this week from Phil L., and he recommended a movie called Hostage Flight. This is a TV film from 1985. I had never heard of it. He told me it was on YouTube, so I watched it one night. And I was hoping to get more of a Die Hard before Die Hard film here. It was more of a saga of when will the passengers step up as a group versus a single white knight film about a hostage takeover. But I gotta tell you, it went pretty hard for a TV film, especially when the terrorists just start blasting certain people mid-flight. Now, this aired on NBC versus the finale of a miniseries called Cain and Abel, and it came in second place with 18.4 million viewers. Just a number like that is kind of insane to me in this day and age. But this was a curious one because I had never heard of it. Phil told me to watch it on YouTube, and then they said to search for the alternate ending, which is actually pretty wild. So the script to this had an ending that NBC did not agree with airing. And I was able to find a New York Times article from November 13th, 1985, and it read like this. It said, the ending, said Ralph Daniels, NBC's vice president in charge of broadcast standards, ran contrary to our standards. Our code, Mr. Daniels added, says that violence may not be used to stimulate the audience or invite imitation, and it may not be shown or offered as an acceptable solution to human problems. This ending violated that principle. In the script originally submitted to NBC, the passengers held their own trial of the terrorists and, after declaring them guilty, hanged them just before the plane landed in London. The producers continued to believe in their original conclusion and filmed both endings at their own expense in the hope that when the network executives actually saw the lynchings on screen, they would recognize their impact, but the network officials would not change their minds. Tony Masucci, NBC's vice president in charge of movies for television, termed the hangings a vigilante ending and said, quote, I don't think we should be in the business of condoning vigilantism. In our version, the passengers still retake the plane, so the film still says that people can stand up and take action to defend themselves, but I don't think we should be doing Death Wish. I don't want to send that message out there, even if it is a popular message. You have to remember that on a bad night, we reach 25 million people, and it would be irresponsible to condone vigilante action. So I'm not going to tell you how it actually ends. It's not a bad TV movie. If you want to find this, you can find it on the Internet Archive, or you can find it on YouTube. And I would highly recommend if you watch the film and you like it, go and check out The Alternate Ending. It starts kind of slow, but it's got a good cast. It's got Ned Beatty as this kind of, I don't know, he doesn't seem that effective as an FBI negotiator, but it's got a solid cast, good performances, and it, like I said, it goes a little bit harder than you would have thought for a 1985 TV movie. Finally, I watched The Last Stop in Yuma County.
Morning.
Did you hear about what's going on in the gas station?
What's that?
Sorry, but our gas pumps are dry. I'm waiting on the fuel truck to show up.
Estimated $700,000. A witness spotted a green Pinto with a damaged rear end fleeing the bank at approximately 6:20 a.m. this morning.
Did you hear about the bank robbery this morning?
How are they doing over there?
It's the car.
Hang up. Pay close attention to what I'm about to tell you.
I had a rich old uncle.
Hey, Charlotte.
You're gonna go about your day just like any other day.
Hey, darling.
He said that when he left, all his money would be mine.
What happened to your phone cord?
Well, you think you're so smart.
If you try anything stupid, I'll shoot you in the face.
I first learned about The Last Stop in Yuma County during Fantastic Fest coverage last year. I knew it was a tight neo-noir crime film that starred Jim Cummings, and that was enough for me. Jim Cummings is one of those people who's a draw for me. Thunder Road, which he wrote, directed, and starred in, is one of the best films of the last 10 years, so he's got some equity with me. The Last Stop in Yuma County largely takes place in one location, the last dusty gas station slash diner combo in the middle of the Arizona desert, miles and miles from the rest of the civilized world. While it's never explicitly said, I suspect that it takes place in 1973 because one character is really obsessed with the Terrence Malick film The Badlands, but I also appreciated that it never told us. The film starts with a knife salesman who remains unnamed throughout the film but is played by the aforementioned Jim Cummings. He rolls into this gas station looking for a fresh tank. Vernon, the gas station owner, played by Big Worm, Faison Love, walks out, lets the man know that the pumps are empty because the gas truck is running late, but it should be there soon. He also lets him know that the attached diner is open and he's welcome to hang out there and have a coffee because the next gas station isn't for another 100 miles. Before he heads in, we get the first piece of exposition from the car's radio. Police are searching for a green Pinto with a dent in the fender. The folks driving it have just pulled off a violent bank robbery. Shortly after the knife salesman sits down for a coffee and a crossword puzzle, that Pinto pulls into the parking lot, and the men inside also walk into the diner, waiting for the gas truck. The tension starts almost immediately when the bank robbers suspect that the knife salesman and the waitress know who they are, but they're all stuck there, so they need to act natural under the thumb of two psychopaths. As the morning rolls on, more people come in, waiting for gas. The robbers waiting for either the fuel truck or somebody with gas who's just stopping by for breakfast. As the audience, we know the truck isn't coming anytime soon because of what we see during the opening credit roll, so it becomes a waiting game, wondering who's gonna slip up first. And once things open up in that diner, it gets real fun. This is an extremely tight script. It's got interesting, believable characters. Everybody has a distinct niche. Nobody is wasted. Jim Cummings is kind of just being who you've already seen him play on screen, in my opinion, but his acting style also hits my wavelength, so that didn't bother me. He just kind of hits the mark of a bumbling loser who has a bit more in the tank than you'd expect once the rubber meets the road. If you told me from the start that this was a Thunder Road or Wolf of Snow Hollow prequel, I'd have believed you. Other standouts in the cast include Jocelyn Donahue as Charlotte, the waitress, who puts on a captivating performance as a person just trying to get a hold of her sheriff husband in creative ways. And Richard Brake, he plays the more collected bank robber. There's a scene where he shows his menace early on, and it was absolutely terrifying. I haven't seen him since Barbarian, but this man can play a hell of a villain. For a first-time feature, Francis Galluppi really impressed me with both his script and his direction. There's nothing unnecessary in the screenplay, and everything that is set up is paid off in extremely satisfying ways. Even more so, there's something that happens at about two-thirds of the way through this that I did not see coming. And then the movie steered into a completely different direction. It's rare that a movie surprises me, but I was sitting there like, whoa, where are we going now? And he and cinematographer Mac Fiskin use clever camera work to make a film that's mostly shot in one sweaty diner seem a little more lifelike. And the shots never seemed gratuitous or showy, something that first-time directors often resort to, instead letting his story and his characters take center stage. When I finished watching this and the dust settled, I was left with a really twisty tale of a bank robbery gone wrong, mixed with Shakespearean levels of greed and the consequences of that greed. It was a movie that I was really hoping I was going to like, and I really ended up liking it a lot. I'm quickly going to add this to my Blu-ray collection when it becomes available. Now, I've seen a lot of reviews, both by critics and casual viewers, comparing this to Quentin Tarantino. And I'm going to be honest, I don't see that. I don't feel that influence. To me, this felt like Francis Galluppi watched the Buck Swope donut shop scene in Boogie Nights and thought, what if that was 90 minutes? To which I say, hell yes. I gave The Last Stop in Yuma County 5 stars on Letterboxd. I highly recommend it to crime film fans. You can find this for digital rental right now. It cost me $7. Or if you have an Alamo Drafthouse near you or a theater playing it near you, you can go see it with a crowd, which I would definitely recommend. And that'll wrap up episode 146 of the Force 5 podcast. I'm going to see you next Monday with James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd himself, joining me to talk top 5 film school essentials. So these are going to be films that film students need to watch, or if you're programming a film class, these are 5 films you're going to want to show those students. So I will talk to you then. In the meantime, while you wait, go watch something that Roger Corman produced.